Welcome to Career Buzz, Canada's unique radio conversation that empowers lives, enriches careers, and energizes organizations. What changes and what stays the same after a 25-year career? Today's Career Buzz guests work in totally different fields, one in financial services, the other in music, and yet they share the perspective of professionals who've invested over 40,000 hours each, traversing the depth and breadth of their respective areas. They've seen their fields change, and they've changed many times. We'll connect the dots across two quarter-century careers on today's Career Buzz. Hi, I'm Mark Franklin, practice leader of Career Cycles. We help people make career and life choices aligned with what really matters. I'm pleased to be your host today on Career Buzz. Thanks for tuning in this morning. David Brill has spent his quarter century in the securities industry. He's been both a bond salesman and trader, a bond broker, an advisor to high net worth clients, and a chief operating officer of an investment dealer, and a research analyst on the equity side. Brill is presently the director of sales and marketing for Baskin Financial Services. We'll find out how he weathered the financial crisis since he last appeared on Career Buzz in 2007. But first, Deborah Stamen's quarter-century career spans roles as performer, opera singer, cantor, voice teacher, and wedding officiant. Earlier, she pursued an operatic career in London, England, and then in Rome. Later, Deborah combined her love for singing and Judaism, entered a cantorial program, and in 1991, earned a Master of Sacred Music and investiture as a cantor. She then served congregations in New Jersey and Florida before returning to her roots here in Toronto. Recently, Deborah released her first CD entitled Mosaic, and stay tuned because we will have a giveaway of that CD. Deborah Stamen joins me live in the studio. Welcome, Deborah.
Good morning, Mark, and thank you very much for having me on Career Buzz.
What do you like about your career these days?
I really enjoy my career because I'm bringing together all the pieces of my journey, and that is I have creative, I can be creative. In that, for example, I just produced my first CD, so I could choose the subject matter, the songs. I'm doing a cabaret of love songs on February 6th at the Annex Live, and I could choose the songs for that, and it's love songs, which are some of my favorite. And I teach voice, which means that I can be creative with each individual student, nurture their voice to their full potential and artistic potential. And I can officiate weddings, which is creative in that I work with each individual couple and I try to find out their story. I write a personal wedding address, which means that every week I'm composing a little composition, an English composition on this couple. And it's just all good.
So that's like I think five different threads of your career. So we have the performer and the musician, and then we have the wedding officiant, and then we have the voice teacher. Well, that's four. There's a lot of different things all happening at once. How do you keep all of the balls in the air? How do you juggle all of that?
Well, it seems to be very easy. One of them is a day-to-day teaching of different wonderful students that come into my studio. And the weddings seem to be more from March through October, and their weekends and Sunday I'm singing the wedding blessings and talking about these couples and what makes them perfect for one another. And then
that's about five of them.
Then my own singing, you know, just keeps me happy when I'm singing.
What are the key strengths that you draw on in your career, the strengths that really empower your career?
Well, I've always been very organized. From day one, I kept a library of my music, and at home, I have these filing cabinets that are alphabetized. Every Broadway musical that I think has almost been written, I have the score and the CD in these filing cabinets. And then I have another I have other binders for my weddings and all the information I give to my couples, and I make packets for them. And so I think organization has been a key factor. And
what else? Like the teaching, you're doing the teaching, and you're also doing the officiating. So there's some of these interpersonal skills, like, you know, because we've had a lot of guests on Career Buzz, and it's interesting to find people who are happy in their careers and how connected, though, that career happiness is to the use of glowing strengths, the strengths that people find they just love to use. So organization is one of them. What are those other glowing strengths
well,
for you?
I like the interpersonal connection with each, the one-on-one mostly, the way it is with my students. They walk in. I get to know them as human beings. I work with their voice like clay, and I understand their temperaments as people as well. And each couple, we become very friendly, as I have about three in-depth meetings with each couple, and they tell me their story and why they are perfect for one another. And, you know, in my personal address, and I like to write, so that's nice. I get to write about them.
All right, that's a good list. We're going to take a little tour of your story and figure out how you got here to this moment of career happiness. So take us back. How far back does your interest in music go?
I was about 12 years old, and the story is quite unusual, I guess, or just it's my mother had made an appointment for my brother to have a singing lesson, and he decided not to go, and I did. But the reason I did is that just that summer I had had a little lead in a musical at camp. So I knew that I could sing, or I liked to sing. Anyway, we went into the studio. It was Miss Simi of the Royal Conservatory of Music. And my mother remembers that she could hardly hear my voice. And I find it hard to believe, but I'd believe it today, because when my young students who are, you know, six, seven, sometimes they come in and it becomes a musical lesson rather than just voice, I can hardly hear their voices, but I know what will be in 2 years from then, or five or ten.
So there's that lucky break that your brother didn't want to go to this thing when he was 12.
So. Yeah. Well, he was a little bit younger, and I was 12. And my teacher was the director of the children's chorus of the Canadian Opera Company, and she put me in that chorus, and from the age of 12 I just fell in love with opera. And my first two operas were La Boheme at the CLC, and I think Turandot, and then Pagliacci. I can't remember the other one right this minute, but I loved it. I would ask my mother to get me excerpts from the opera. She would bring them home, Renata Tibaldi and Maria Callas, and I would listen to them, and that was my life in my teenage years.
So it was a very much a natural affinity for music, and then it sound. I know that you did study music as an undergrad. Was that an easy choice? Because so often we sometimes think, well, now when I hit post-secondary, I should really be doing something more practical, and yet you did manage to stick with your love and do it right through to an undergraduate degree.
Yeah, I went through with Miss Simi from the age of 12 through the Royal Conservatory to a Bachelor of Music, and no one in my family, my parents, Bernard and Shirley, they were always very supportive of me. They never said, do anything more practical.
So they didn't say, Deborah, go into accounting, it'll be much better.
Absolutely not. I never heard that once.
We're talking to Deborah Stamen here on Career Buzz on CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm your host, Mark Franklin. So, Deborah, what happened after you graduated? I know there's part of your story there where you end up in London and you have this opera career. How quickly did this music career start for you after you graduated?
Well, I graduated here, and then I went off to London, England, and I studied further at the Guildhall School of Music and Drama. And then I started to get into operas. They were smaller community. There's a lot of little opera companies in London, and it's wonderful. It's a wonderful way to get experience. But I really didn't have a work permit, so that was a stumbling block, which led me then. And I was struggling. I was struggling to find my way then without being able to have a work permit. And also I wanted to develop more vocally, and I went off and I studied with Tito Gobbi in Florence. I got into his master class, which is a very was a wonderful, wonderful opportunity to sing with him. He was a baritone, and he sang with Maria Callas. And that led me to go and study further and to move to Rome for a year and a half. And then I decided I couldn't really just stay in Rome. It's not the right place for a North American, particularly, to continue an operatic
yes.
career. It's hard.
So, and did you get a break there? Were you starting to perform at that stage?
No, not in Rome. That would have been difficult because I wasn't Italian, and it isn't the same as London. So
yes.
I had a friend in New York City, and I just went and followed her. It was just that I decided to move to New York. So really, I knew one person in New York, moved to New York, and that was when a struggle began because I realized I wasn't going to have the career that I had dreamt about.
And which was the glorious
yes.
stage career of the opera star.
Yes.
That was the dream.
That was the dream.
Uh-huh. And
huge.
It wasn't until you moved to New York that you started to let go of that dream?
Yes.
What age were you at that point?
I was about 31.
31, and you stuck with that dream all the way, almost from childhood, it sounds like.
Yeah, and I stuck with it even farther than that. That was just the beginning.
Yeah.
Because I moved to New York, and I was a secretary by day for a computer consulting firm, so I was probably on one of the first word processors. And at night, I would take singing lessons and dance lessons and drama lessons. I spent all my money that I made as a secretary on that. I had a roommate. I gave her my bedroom, and I slept in the living room. I was struggling on the Upper West Side, but I can't. It was a wonderful, wonderful experience. New York, I would just go to the opera. As I did in London, I stood every night. It was just wonderful. However, I realized then about when I got to be 31, 32, I had to accept that I wasn't going to have a career because you need to have had it by the time. You need to be on a roll by the time you're 30. If you don't have the break, or I didn't have the actual talent or the technique to hold up to this rigorous career. And remember, there's only one opera company in a major city in
yes.
the States. It's not like there are many law firms in each city, and there's only one role for a soprano in every opera, so maybe it's just difficult.
For listeners who might be experiencing something similar, where they have a certain dream and time passes and they hit a certain age and they start to realize, you know, this was the dream, and it doesn't mean that, you know, one's career turns and things happen. But what can you say about your emotional state as you were kind of dealing with that inner conflict about, do I pursue the dream, do I let it go and find something else?
It was a struggle that lasted 6 years.
Wow.
I didn't let it go for another six, so we're now 36 years old. It was sad. It was, I had a lot of fear. The important thing is I started to take steps. So what I did first was I left the secretarial work because I really didn't enjoy that, the 9 to 5 and typing. And I had very good secretarial skills by that time. I left and I started to teach. And I made that step. And what I did and what I learned was that I actually enjoyed teaching. I mean, when I left the secretariat, I said, what can I do? And the only thing I really could do with a Bachelor of Music and all was teach. So I did, and then I enjoyed the teaching, and I realized that I was getting results.
This was teaching voice.
And then I would see time pass, and I was actually getting results with these students. You know, I was a young singer still, so but I'd had enough wonderful teachers between Miss Simi at U of T, and then in London, and then in Rome, and in New York City, I had wonderful teachers at the same time that I started to teach. So I drew from all these teachers, and I became, you know, a little bit of them passed on from me.
Do you remember what the first kind of clue was that led you to teach? The first thing where you finally said to yourself, okay, this isn't working out, I'll try something, I'll try teaching. Do you remember what it was?
Yes, I absolutely couldn't bear doing the secretarial work anymore.
So it was like the leaving from as opposed to the going to,
it
and
was.
You were just casting about. But the idea of the teaching, that was that an obvious thing for you?
Yeah, I said, what can I do?
Yep.
It's like exiting and going and then into something else. And I thought, what could I do? Well, I'll teach. And I think you have to make the first steps when you're, when you feel like you're not, this isn't me, and I love music. Now, these are still, though, as I taught, I felt isolated, and I was still young, and I wanted, and I had so much more singing to do. I couldn't just start to teach. I felt I was too young and hadn't sung enough. And when I was up until the point of that time, about 82, there were no women cantors, and this is where we're going. When I lived in London in 79, I met a rabbinic student because I was singing in synagogues all that time. I sang for 8 years already as a professional singer in synagogues. He told me about a woman cantor, and that remained with me.
And if listeners aren't clear about what a cantor is, can you just describe that?
It's the clergy. It's the musical clergy who works with the rabbi. So there's a rabbi and the cantor, and the rabbi's expertise is rabbinical texts and teaching those, and the cantor's expertise is liturgical, the prayers and the music of our tradition.
Yes.
And we do the bar mitzvahs, and we train them, and we do the choirs and the synagogue, but we do the same things at chaplaincy. And so I decided I had an interview at Hebrew Union College at the same time that I was teaching, and it took me 5 years to really. At that interview, the rabbi said, go take this book list, read this list of books that were on Jewish topics, prayers, whatever, and also join Stephen Wise Free Synagogue in New York City, where one of the first women cantor was, because the first woman cantor was invested in 1975, and I was in London at the time, already graduated from U of T, so...
And up until that point in the history of Judaism, there were no women cantors.
I was shocked when this Jeffrey Cohen, who's now a rabbi in Australia, told me this. I thought, my goodness, but you have to be super religious. And if anybody who's Jewish out there knows, I thought, you have to have payas, which is like the black hat and very Orthodox. What a woman. And I was in shock. And so when I got to New York, this remained with me. This was a seed that didn't go away. And then I joined this synagogue. I had this interview at Hebrew Union College, then joined the synagogue in New York and sat in the pews for about 4 years and observed this woman on the bima. And then I decided to have, and as I said, one of the most important things is to take little steps. So I'm teaching at this time in my own studio in New York. But then I decided I would go to the synagogue, and then I decided to have an adult bat mitzvah. I became part of an adult B'nai Mitzvah group in New York City. And because I was never bat mitzvahed as a young girl,
yes,
that was not encouraged in Toronto or anywhere. And I had an adult bat mitzvah. And after that adult bat mitzvah, it was in the year of 86, I think, 87, I decided I'm going to apply to Hebrew Union College. And that cantor served as my sort of mentor during that time.
And was that also the master's degree that I mentioned,
yes,
at the beginning?
There's two
degrees. Master of Sacred Music.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I hadn't heard of that. That's really interesting. This was at the Hebrew Union
College
in New York City.
All cantors who are invested get that degree. It's an academic degree. There are two different ceremonies. One is where we get that Master of Sacred Music. The rabbinic students get their rabbinic, I'm not sure what that's called, their Masters of Rabbinic Studies. And then we are all ordained, or the cantors invested, in a very large ceremony, a Temple Emmanuel in New York City.
Hmm. Is there an equivalent of that Master of Sacred Music in other faith traditions?
This is the Reform Movement, Hebrew Union College. I think there might, in other traditions.
In Christian traditions and others, do they have something like that?
Well, they don't have cantors per se, but they would have
a musical
tradition.
Absolutely. Of service.
Mm-hmm.
And then investiture, does that now give you is that the divine right,
yes,
or is that the legal right to do the things?
That's the divine and legal. And the only place, which segues us to the another thing, legal, is that that's what gives me power invested in me to marry people, because I, through that investiture, then I could be licensed clergy in Ontario. I applied for a license. So I have that license to marry people.
Now, and if people here in Ontario, do you need to be have that kind of divine connection? Do you need to have done that master's degree to become an officiant, or are there other ways to do that province?
There are other ways through the legal way of being a minister of the peace, justice of the peace, or an attorney. I don't know the other way. That's the other way, and my way is the clergy. So on a marriage license, it says clergy, other, or judge, or something.
But that makes it mm-hmm. official according to the legal documents. Right. We're talking to Deborah Stamen here on Career Buzz. I'm your host, Mark Franklin, on CIUT 89.5 FM. So, Deborah, then what happened afterwards? I said in the intro also you went and you served as a cantor in Florida and New Jersey.
Yes.
Just give us an overview of what that was like before coming back to Toronto.
Yeah, my first congregation was in New Jersey, and It was wonderful. I enjoyed it. There are issues that come up that the congregation couldn't afford to keep me on. They went part time, so these things happen. And then I got another congregation in Florida, and that was an interesting time too. But there's always things that come up that, you know, I learned that the cantorate in reality wasn't what I thought it was going in. I went in for two different reasons. One of them was I wanted that opportunity to learn about my heritage. That really was something that why I wanted to study and go to Hebrew Union College. I was always wondering, for example, my grandfather, he used to lead our Alexander Stamen, he used to lead our Pesach services in Hebrew. And I thought, wow, how did he do that? And how? I wanted to be able to do that myself. And I can say I can do that. I can lead a Seder and in Hebrew today. I really wanted to be able to do that. And I wanted to be able to have the ability to continue the legacy.
And what was the other reason? You said two reasons?
The music and being with congregants and doing the sort of pastoral work, I thought would be wonderful. However, the cantorate was changing just as I was graduating, and the music, and we're talking about the reform movement in the States, the nature of the cantorate was changing tremendously right on top of me, right in my time. The music that was being chosen in the States was more folk, guitar. That wasn't me. I actually learned to play the guitar. I picked up the guitar. People at cantorial school thought it was funny to see me, this operatic type voice, picking up the guitar. And, you know, things don't turn out exactly the way you thought they would again.
Which has been a theme of the guests on the show here. And it's so interesting. You go into something for a variety of reasons, and then you get into it, and you realize it's not quite what you thought. Or it is for a while, and then it changes.
And then it changes.
Right? And so much has changed in music and in the cantorial world of work. Listeners are also curious about how much money people make when they do different things. And for this profession, and you're in the States, so it's a bit of a different thing, but can you give listeners an idea? Like, how's the money in cantorial work?
Well, it's a living. What I can say about any of this is that I never did any of this for the money. Money was not a factor. And I am today quite a practical person. And in many ways, I always saved. I am a practical person. But you don't do any of this for the money. I was a struggling singer on the Upper West Side. I wasn't making anything. The cantorial work it's all a passion. I love the cantorial music. The traditional, what we call Nusach Hazanut, modal, florid, melismatic, a very rich tradition. But I studied it for 4 years, and then, you know, I didn't really use it in the cantorate in the real world. But again, coming back to the money, we make, as cantors, depending on the congregation, an ample living. And we have a pension. Did you really want figures?
No, listeners are always curious. I always get emails and calls after a show. Well, how much they want? It's interesting, practical information. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'm hearing that it's an ample living. Like, it's not bad once you get there.
It's not bad once you get there. But it's not. You're not overflowing. You know, you have a pension, and you can live comfortably, depending on your congregation.
And in just a couple of minutes now, Deborah, because I want to get to a piece of music that you actually brought. But you've come back to Toronto. You were in the States. You've come back to Toronto. You've shifted your career again. Can you just give us an overview of what brought you back and what's happening now?
Because I decided to have more control over my own life and to go to it. I was always moving from Toronto to London to Rome to New York to New Jersey to Florida for my career. And I finally made a decision at a certain moment to go to a place and build my life around the place rather than my career. It was the best decision I ever made, because then I had to decide, who am I? What am I going to do? And I'm going to teach. For sure, I went back to the teaching, and I'm very happy as a teacher. But today, I also sing all the time, because I do the weddings, which means that I can sing at the weddings, I can be creative, I can be with people. I still use the cantaret. And then I go back to the very roots, right at the beginning of the 12-year-old roots of singing. So I'm always using my voice, and I'm teaching, and I'm passing on all that information from all those 27 years away international exposure I pass on to my students.
And you're
today.
Also performing, and I know you have a performance coming
and
up.
And I do, yes, February 6th, Cabaret of Love Songs. And it's at the Annex Live. It's 296 Brunswick Avenue. And it's 2:30 to 4:30 on the Sunday. And anybody who books in advance, the first 50 get a free CD along with it. I released this CD in Mosaic on November 28th this year. And it was such a success that I decided to go for the Love Cabaret.
And we will have a giveaway of that very CD towards the end of the show, so stay tuned. Finally, Deborah, from all the twists and turns in your career, from the changes that have happened with you, what can you say about what you've personally learned about making career and life choices?
I think it's important to be very open to everything that's happening around you, and to have quiet time to decide what it is that you really, really want to do. Follow your passion. Do something that will make you happy along the way. The process is very important. It's the journey. It's not the destination that counts. And you have to find your affinity, where your affinity lies. Follow that passion and try to get a mentor who will help you with that journey, who can advise you, give you a little more information. That's one of the things I think that I lacked in my life, was a mentor that could be objective and to help me. So, but I think everybody, use your intuition. You can use your intuition and follow that intuition.
And if listeners do want to find out more about you, where do they go?
Two websites, because that reflects the light cycles again, www.singingstudio.ca and jewishlifecycles.ca.
And I'll have links to that on the Career Buzz, linked on the Career Cycles website. Thanks so much for telling us your story, Deborah. Please stick around, because at the end I'd like to ask you a few more questions about the overall themes of today. But you did bring a piece of music. So do you want to just set up the piece of music that you brought for us?
You're going to hear Go Down Moses. And I think I picked this because it reflects my new CD is called Mosaic. And Mosaic, it's a compilation of the pieces of my musical life. And Mosaic is also refers to Jewish component, which Moses is. Go down, Moses, and exit. You exit, and when you exit something, you enter another place. So that reflects the journey also.
Perfect metaphor. Thank you so much for joining us here, Deborah Stamen.
Thank you, Mark. It's been a great pleasure.
Thank you. WDIUT can now be heard on channel 946 through Rogers Digital Cable.
Like what you're hearing and want more of it? Check out our schedule at CIUT.FM. We have over 80 unique programs we're sure you'll love. We're listener supported. CIUT 89.5 FM.
Welcome back to Career Buzz. I'm your host, Mark Franklin. Before moving on to our next interview, I want to let listeners know you can join Verge Magazine and Career Cycles for a small group career and life clarification experience on the theme of travel with purpose for career and life enrichment. It's Wednesday, February 2 at 6:15 at 873 Broadview, and more information is available on the Career Cycles website, careercycles.com. David Brill has spent the past quarter century working in the securities industry. He's been both a bond salesman and trader, a bond broker and advisor to high net worth clients, a COO of an investment dealer, and a research analyst on the equity side. You could say he's played both sides of the stock and bond street. Brill, as he's generally known, is presently the director of sales and marketing for Baskin Financial Services. He's got a BCom from the University of Toronto and a master's of business administration from the Wharton School. David Brill, welcome back to Career Buzz this morning.
Thanks so much, Mark. It's very good to be back. I haven't been back in a few years. But
that's right. Well, it's I checked and it was February 2007 when you last joined us here on Career Buzz, which I noticed was just before the financial meltdown. So we're pleased to have you back here. What are you doing these days?
Right now, I'm working at Baskin Financial as the director of sales and marketing. So I am meeting with people regularly, a lot, all the time, to do some show and tell, show them and tell them about the services that we offer. We manage money on a discretionary basis for high net worth individuals, and we have things that make us a little bit different. So I'm in there pitching and selling and showing it to people, and then if they're interested, I bring them in for meetings inside of our firm.
What are you enjoying about it?
The people. Both inside my firm, they're terrific. They're very good at what they do, and they're very decent and honest and nice people. But I'm also meeting a ton of people outside the office. We don't pitch institutionally, so we don't look for pension fund money or mutual fund money. We are going, literally, we go person by person or family by family. And everyone's got a different story of where they are in their lives, how they've made their money, how their money's being managed, if they're happy, if they're not. So I get to meet a ton of people from a ton of walks of from many different walks of life, and that's what I'm enjoying the most about it.
And the strengths that you bring to this, what are those personal and professional strengths that you're using on a regular basis?
Well, okay, so I'll turn it around and say the professional strengths have to be, I would think, my education and my experience, because I studied for a long time business, finance, investments. And so I understand what David Baskin and the team at Baskin Financial, the other two portfolio managers, are doing, trying to do, their successes and what they do in good markets and tough markets. So I can really understand our strategy and what we're trying to do in the management of people's money. So that, on a professional basis, works very well. The personal strength, my ability to take the information, the knowledge I have, and the experience that I've had, and boil it down so that people who are not investment professionals can understand what we are doing. And also, I have a little bit of ability to teach. I don't do a lot of it, certainly, but it's boiling it down and explaining what we do. And I'm a people person. I've had other jobs where I haven't been around people, and it just makes me somewhat crazy. I'm like an animal in a cage. So I like to get out, see people. It's energy. I think I draw energy from other people
Yes.
and from meeting them. And so being out of the office half of the time is really great for me.
Right. So, and listeners would get that, right? Some people do feel like they're using their strengths all the time and they feel great. And other people feel like the animal in the cage that you just described. So, you know, take us back a bit here. Now, if people missed your first appearance on Career Buzz in February 2007, here's two sentences that I used to introduce you back then. I dug into the archives here, and it was kind of similar. It says, you know, he's been a money market and a bond salesman. He's traded treasury bills and bonds and was a bond broker, from accounting to wealth management to research analyst. So, give us the highlights. What actually happened up till February 2007? Because then I want to take us from there, but I want to get the kind of the backstory.
The backstory is just like riding a roller coaster, so I hope people may identify this, they may not, but it was a story of not knowing myself, thinking knowing myself, doing what I think I should do as opposed to what I should be doing. Early in my career, I wanted to be a professional, wasn't interested really in the law, and I thought doctors only worked with sick people, which is probably true. I think medicine's very interesting, but I wanted to be a professional, but it wasn't medicine or dentistry, and it wasn't law. I went into accounting. Now, why did I go into accounting? I was really good at accounting, but that's only half the equation, I think, when picking a career. So I was really good at it, but then I got into it, and I couldn't believe people audited for a living. They looked at what other people did. I was, frankly, fairly shocked, and I remember I did it for a couple of years before business school, but when I left a big firm, they didn't want me to leave, and I finally said this to a couple of partners who were very interested in my career. I said, look, I didn't want to go into medicine because I didn't want to work with sick people. Now I'm in accounting. I'm working with dead people. At that point, they said, okay, you can leave. And I went to a smaller
And you were released.
I was released. I went to a smaller accounting firm where it was a little bit better. But the big thing was I was going back to business school. I did. So it was a case of not knowing myself. I didn't really like the world of accounting. However, I picked up some skills that I still use today in how to read financial statements. So I guess that's all right.
And that choice to go back to business school, because you hear that a lot with younger professionals. Maybe they have a BCom, maybe an engineering background. And a lot of people debate that. Should I or should I not do an MBA? The MBA has changed over the years, and it may be a bit different today than it was when you did it. What was it? What was the kind of trigger that said, yes, I really should do this for you?
Well, I loved school, so let's start with that. So I'm always looking, I was always looking for more education. The MBA was accepted. And here's the thing about the MBA, and I found this when I met people at Wharton, is a lot of them had done things and had done really what I thought were really great things. Like they had run campaigns for senators in the United States. Some had been in the armed forces. Some were doctors trying to learn how to administer a hospital. Some had been nurses. Some had their own businesses. But the thing about business school where I went was that everybody wasn't sure about what the next step was going to be. So they're taking more business courses and getting much needed credibility and ability to network with movers and shakers who had already gone to the school, alumni. And then they would meet other people at the school, including the professors, but the other students, and maybe head out on another path. So graduate business school at a good school opens doors, but also maybe identify some of the doors that you may want to go through.
Mm-hmm.
So you pick up some technical skills, and that's all good, but it's really about the people you meet, frankly.
So that's important, right? And I've heard that before, but often people don't think about that. And when they make the decision, they think they're doing it either for the credential or for the knowledge. But years afterwards, what are you left with? Maybe, well, the credential sticks around. The knowledge probably changes so dramatically that it's not relevant anymore anyways. But is it the network? Like these years later, has that network still, are you still connected to it? Does it still help you?
I am connected. It does help me. And I mean, there, because I went to U.S. Business School, the network isn't as big in Toronto and Canada as it would be if I was in the United States. But I still am in touch, and the network does help. And, I want to add this, and this is no small thing. There's a group of us, and probably 20 people from Wharton that I'm still in touch with, and their families. And I go to family events that they have, and we have reunions, and we travel around. And these are people – listen, I wasn't in the armed forces. I wasn't in combat. But when you go through something tough with people,
yes,
there's a bond that forms, and that bond is for life. So I met some tremendous people at school.
So now what happened? What's the trajectory of the career up till 2007 after business school?
Well, it's funny. It's always conversations you have. I remember I was in the refectory with a guy that I'm not close to and I wasn't close to then, and he said, – Brill, how's it going? And I go, how's it going? It's going fine at school, but I'm a little bit worried about what's going to happen after. All these people, I don't think they get it. They want to be rich, but they're willing to work 100 hours a week to do it. I don't want to make more than $3.37 an hour. And he said, you want to be a trader. And I said, I don't want to be wearing those funny jackets on a stock exchange yelling at people or an options exchange. He goes, there's other kinds of traders. And he put me in touch with a lot of people he knew in Toronto, actually. He was American, but he knew people in Toronto. And I got in touch with those people and got onto a trading room where I was trading fixed income instruments, and it was a different story, but very exciting, and I loved it for a while. You got to know it's a young man's game, and you got to know that every trader out there has made money and lost money, and often when you lose money, they fire you. And that did happen after a number of years. It was great. Then when you get fired, you kind of lose your mojo and
yes,
you lose your confidence. Not such a great thing. And I'm going to say it again: trading is for younger people, certainly younger than I am now. After that, it was, what am I going to do next? I knew a lot of people. I knew the financial industry. I did some work for a company that did work with high net worth individuals. We had tax assisted products, which then worked. The government came down and they don't work anymore. And so there was a good 6 or 7 years with them, and it was good until it wasn't anymore, and we didn't have the kind of products. Because of legislation, things change, as Deborah said. Things always change.
So you have to go with the flow. And in that industry, it is a regulated industry. And and the regulators are always trying to keep up with the industry, it sounds like. And then they do, and then things change, and your career changes.
That's absolutely true. And for a while, I had a contract position as a COO, which was different again, because it was like running a very small company. I was helping the head of that company sell the company. It was a contract position. He got rid of it. And the contract ended, and that was that. And it was funny because I was trying a few different new things, and then there was an executive search person, a headhunter, who was in touch with my wife, and she knew my wife, and she kept calling because my wife has also got a ton of experience in the financial business. And I said, well, maybe I should talk to Sharon, her first name Sharon. And she said, well, would you like to meet the CEO of this investment bank? And I said, well, I'm always up for meeting a CEO. I mean, that's what they teach at Wharton. You get an appointment with the CEO, you meet the CEO. But I didn't know what they were thinking. I had a CFA at the time. That's what financial analysts, or that's what equity analysts have.
Certified financial analyst.
That's right.
Right? Yeah.
And I should have said it, except it's chartered financial analyst.
But sorry? Chartered
financial analyst. But I had that designation. Equity analysts have that. And he said, well, we're looking for an equity analyst. And I'm thinking, I don't think this is going to suit me. I think you got to spend a lot of time with numbers and reports and writing. The writing was okay. But I went and had a couple of good years doing it, actually, and speaking to a lot of people, more than I thought, and kind of enjoyed it. But then I was looking to move maybe up to a higher level, or to a better firm or more recognized firm, and the remuneration would have gone accordingly. And I went to a different firm where it was, frankly, it was a lot more strict in terms of what you could say and what you could do. I found I couldn't use my sense of humor at the second firm that I could at the first. And it was much more in a cage, in a room with the financial statements from the company as I was looking at.
What was that position? Was that a research analyst position?
It was. It was equity research analyst, special situations.
So even within one job title, right? Like, let's say there's a BCom person listening to this and they're thinking, gee, that's a good job for me. There's quite a range. One place you get to do a lot of the interpersonal and communication and interviewing, and another place it's the same job, completely different kind of work environment.
It was, for some reason. The people at the second job didn't like to talk to each other. It was a strange, strange community of people who I don't think belonged together, and so I was alone a lot. And it was 2 years, and I just really hated it. And again, you know, it reminds me of Deborah when you have to make a move, because I just couldn't stand it anymore. And I remembered my days kind of selling and being with people and thought, what can I sell and that's unique and that I can show people and get out there? And I was thinking actually of the world of insurance, which insurance didn't really do anything for me as a product, but I liked what insurance people were doing for others and how they were meeting with people in their own hours and things. And I was thinking of going down that road, and then happenstance, I ran into Barry Schwartz, who is the number two man at Baskin, and he is owns part of the company. Young guy, been there 11 years. We were at a CFA function, and I'd had a couple of drinks, probably spoke more than I should have. And Barry and I hit it off, and I told him what I wanted and what I was thinking, and he said, you know, we could use your marketing skills. And come in and have a talk with us. And
so hang on. I just want to step back to this word happenstance that you used a moment ago. Mm-hmm. So you said it's happenstance as if it was pure chance or random, but you went to the event, right?
I did.
You were the one who talked to the guy.
Mm-hmm.
You were the one who actually drank enough that it would loosen you up so that you would have the good conversation.
Yes.
And I just want to make note of the things that were going on at the time that maybe it was a career mistake. I don't know if you call it that, but you felt like the caged animal that you're describing. Would you say that also, you know, allowing that kind of desire, the career desire for something more because you weren't getting it, you wanted to be more communicating with people, and that desire also taking note of it was something that was in the mix when you met Barry that first time?
For sure it was in the mix. I realized I needed to be out there and seeing people and talking to people and working with people and not by myself.
Right. So let's just, you know, step aside from the happenstance thing and look at all the different things that you actually did to make that perfect moment come together. Right? Because it doesn't help people to think, well, it was just luck, because how can they make luck happen? But you got clear about your desire, wanting more people interaction, right? That one. You took yourself out to an event. You had a few drinks, which is maybe an important part of the whole career thing, and
just
you had
two,
that
just
important
two. I want to say just two, Mark.
So what happened? He invited you for the interview and something happened.
Well, yeah. So I ran into Barry, and I'd known the name Baskin Financial because they do a lot of television, radio, and they're in the newspaper. So David Baskin is someone that I'd heard of and had seen on television, and Barry is someone I'd never met, but we started talking. We had a good time talking to others at that event, and he said, why don't you come in and talk with us? And so I went in and met David, who's he's a very fine man, and he's a very decent man, he's a very honest man, as is Barry, and he said, you need to put together what you would do, marketing plan, compensation plan. The marketing plan for me was easy. I kind of knew what to do, whether it was I'd done some before, and it just seems to come to me. And then the compensation plan I had to make up for myself, but that's okay. And then we had discussions, and mid-October I started, and that was mid-October of 2010, started working at Baskin, and you start by picking up the phone, picking up the email, telling everybody where you are, and the rest is, I mean, it's going great, and I'm busy after this. I've got a meeting. I've got another meeting this afternoon. It's terrific. People are great. They work well together. I have freedom in my life. I come and go as I please. My job is to see. I just can't tell you how much I'm enjoying it. I really am enjoying it.
Yeah, no, the energy comes across. Like, I can hear you're kind of smiling as you're talking about it.
Yeah.
We're talking to David Brill here. He's actually the Director of Sales and Marketing for Baskin Financial Services. He's doing a repeat performance here on Career Buzz. You're taking us to 2010, but we met you last in 2007, and in between those two time points was a financial meltdown. What happened, and where were you during all of that chaos?
I was at the second investment bank that I worked at as a research analyst, and this is maybe a bit of luck too, because I was ramping up, and when you're ramping up, you have to start again. If you go to an investment bank, even though you have a bunch of companies you cover and you know very well, or an industry, you can't take your work from the first investment bank to the second investment bank, because it's the first investment bank's property. You have to do it again. Now, you can do it faster because you know them, but you still can do it again. So I was spending a lot of time ramping up, and when I would look up or take a break, I would see how badly the markets were doing, thinking, wow, am I glad? I mean, personally, of course, I was invested in and suffering along with everybody else. Well, am I glad professionally? I don't have my reports out, and I haven't said, oh, you should buy this as the thing is going down the toilet. So for me, I was there. The firm, I'll say this about the second firm I was at, they're very prudent. They actually cut salaries 5 to 10%, but they stayed in business. They stayed solvent. And
layoffs?
They didn't do any layoffs.
No layoffs?
No.
Everybody accepted a 5 to 10% cutback?
Yeah. And bonuses, which can be a big part of compensation, went to nothing. But people kept their jobs. We kept doing what we were doing. It was a very difficult atmosphere. And it was, you know, I'm thinking to myself, like, at what point am I going to put a pin in and, you know, tell people that this stock is cheap enough and to buy? And that was difficult. But you do it, and things did turn around, so it worked out. So for me professionally, I was certainly not making a lot of money and certainly not enjoying a lot of success. Nobody in the business was at that time. But we survived.
But you survived. You stuck with it. So something actually happened pretty good compared to what we heard. A lot of investment banks, like, they just, that was it. A lot of people lost their jobs. So did you consider yourself, you know, grateful, lucky during that time when you were seeing the carnage all around?
I did consider myself grateful and lucky. And then the thing was, like, this went on for a while, and I'm thinking, I don't really like this. And who the hell would make a change now when everybody's out there looking? Like, so that kept me there longer because, you know, the firm treated people decently and didn't just do wholesale layoffs. And I don't know what was out there. And, like, am I going to find a job in this chosen field? So probably kept me at a job doing, because was I even allowed to think I didn't like this because things were so bad? So I had to give myself permission to decide I didn't like it and then give myself permission to think about what else I wanted to do.
Now, that's an interesting insight. I think it was true for a lot of people during the recession, not just in financial services, that they were sitting on their hands waiting, and did they give themselves permission to say, I don't like this? Because once you start doing that, you start to think of alternatives, and then you feel like, well, we're in a recession. Can I really do that? How do you think the rest of your colleagues in the financial services are dealing with this idea of career change, right? They stuck around 2009, 2010. You made a move in 2010. Here we are in 2011. How are things looking, and how do you think the mood is for both employers to hire and people to move and make changes in their careers?
I think things are looking much better, and anything can happen. I understand that, and there are things that we don't know. I mean, perfect example is, like, apparently Egypt is going through a revolution right now. This is something we wouldn't have known, and I don't think Egypt's revolution is going to severely affect the financial markets or the world economy. But things happen that you don't expect. So taking that out of the mix, because you can't plan for that, there aren't any real scary monsters on the horizon that we can see. I think we are in the upswing, and I think this is a good time for people both inside financial services and outside to be looking around. Employers outside of financial services is starting to really rock and roll. It's usually the first industry or one of the first industries to see it down, and one of the first to see things come back, and,
yes,
and things are coming back. Having said that, in the real world, assuming financial industries is not the real world, because I've been out of the real world, I guess, for my whole career, in the real world, companies have learned to make do with less, and so they've increased their productivity. They're getting the same output from less people, and they've really learned to do that. But as time goes on and they feel more comfortable, it's about what the owners or the shareholders or the board of directors feel. As they feel more comfortable, they will start taking on people. So I'm very optimistic that our unemployment rate will go down, or our employment rate will come up in this country and even in the United States. Things are coming back. They're going to continue to come back. And one thing for listeners to remember is that the unemployment rate or the amount of people at work is what's called a lagging indicator. They're the last thing to come out of a recession, and they will start to do it now.
We're talking to David Brill here on Career Buzz. I'm your host, Mark Franklin, on CIUT 89.5 FM. We do have a few more minutes in the show here, and we do have the giveaway of Deborah's CD called Mosaic. So if listeners have a comment or question for either guest, especially, the perspective, the quarter century perspective that we're talking here, please do give us a call with a comment or a question. The number to call is 416-946-7000. That's 416-946-7000. Give us a call and let us know what your comment or question is on today's show. So David, now, given all of the twists and turns in your story now, and especially the most recent couple of years, what can you say that you've learned about making good career and life choices?
I think I would say if people want to be happy at what they do, it would help if they have two things going for them. They enjoy it, and Deborah said that. So important. That's number one. Number two, I think it's very helpful if they're good at it. So if they can marry the two. Like, I was good at accounting, but I didn't enjoy it. I was good as a research analyst, at least I think I was, but I didn't enjoy it. It really helps to be good at something and to enjoy it. And then I guess the last piece of it, and, you know, Deborah tells this story well, too. She's a great guest to have. Sometimes you've got to be young enough to realize the dream early. Should I have been a sports broadcaster and gone on the radio? Man, I think I would have loved that. But...
And you do have a great radio voice, Brill. It's amazing.
I appreciate that, Mark. But, you know, I have spoken to professionals, and guys have really made it. Like, there's a guy out of Toronto who is now ESPN, like, Game of the Week Baseball. And, I mean, his name's Dan Shulman. You'll never meet a nicer guy. He's from Toronto. He's a friend of mine, and I met him. His story is a good one, and maybe you should meet Dan, and maybe I can do that for you. Dan was going to be an actuary and, like, had done, I think, 4 of the 8 exams. And hated, but he was young. He was in his 20s, early 20s. And then he said, I want to be, he didn't say a line tamer, but I want to be a radio guy. And he went to Barry and went on like community radio. And I think he was reading obituaries. And then he got a break with the Blue Jays as the radio man and went from there into college basketball, et cetera, et cetera. Dan Shulman is one of the top play-by-play men today in the world. He's with ESPN. He still lives in Toronto, travels a ton, doesn't love that. But I think at this point, you've got to be realistic about your age and what you can do to make a change. So Dan said to me, I never tell you not to pursue that dream, except for it's extremely, extremely difficult to break in and at your age. So you've got to be realistic. And I hate to do that. I hate to take away anybody's dreams. So maybe I should tell people when they're dreaming, dream young and go after it young. Bob Dylan said, when you ain't got nothing, you got nothing to lose. When you're older, you got to be more realistic. But still, if you don't enjoy what you're doing, what are you left with?
So let's open it up. And Deborah, if you have a comment on this one as well, you know, we'll have listeners here who are at the quarter century. We have a lot of listeners who are younger, right? And now from the perspective of your quarter century career, and especially picking up on this so-called the realistic analysis of career choices, what's the perspective if somebody is in their 20s, let's say, or even early 30s and listening, and they're feeling some disconnect between what they're doing and their dreams? What would you tell them?
You want to take that one, Deborah?
Just sit back, be quiet, take some time to meditate on it, and take the first steps. But find something that you again enjoy, your passion, and that you think you do would do, again, as David said, do well. I knew singing. I loved to sing. So that's something I knew and I could do well. And that's where you need to start. And also, today I'm the happiest I've ever been. I mean, and who would have ever known? And go with the flow. Don't fight it, because you may actually, at a time when you think things are the darkest, and they may be it's a sunset, it's really, for you, the beginning of a sunrise. It's just the beginning of something great, and that's what you have to keep in mind, that this sad and fearful time is going to, could, if you take the time and you search well, could be fabulous for you.
Well, it's an element of faith to say that, right? Mm-hmm. Like if somebody is feeling bad, and your story, Brill, of the broadcaster, you know, and he didn't know where it was going to go, and I'm sure he had his dark days thinking, what am I, nuts? Like I should have stuck with the actuarial route. You know, this isn't working. I'm reading the obituaries or whatever. You know, and there's an element of having the faith. Like maybe that's what he would say if we were talking to him about that. So that you need to believe that the it's going to go somewhere. The dots will connect. And how do you maintain that faith?
Well, that, I think that's something in a personality too. Again, you can't just wait for it to happen. You have to take the steps. When you're young. Like, I did what I wanted. I followed my passion, so I have no regrets now. I think when you're really young, you should follow your passion. Then you won't have any regrets. How about you, David? What do you say?
Well, I just think the other thing is your personality. So Deborah took a quiet moment and thought about it, or lots of quiet moments. And for me, what did I do? I went out and talked to people. And I asked what people thought. Lots of people from different, very much like what I do now. But what did they think? What did they think about me? And where would I fit? And what do they do? And so also taking into what people, and a lot of people are going to tell you a lot of different things, but then you filter it down.
Well, that's great. I appreciate that. The two different personality perspectives coming here. And I think you got to use your natural instincts, go inside, go outside. And maybe the perfect combination is to do a little bit of both. And you get it all in here. Thank you so much for joining us here on Career Buzz. Deborah Stamen, David Brill. Appreciate you coming back to Career Buzz. We're just going to wrap up with one more song, Deborah, of yours. And if listeners do want to call in, just leave us your contact info and get a copy of Deborah's CD, Mosaic. And it's 416-946-7000. And we're just going to play one song on the outro. What's that song?
It's Adieu by Gabrielle Fauré.
You've been listening to Career Buzz, Canada's unique radio conversation that empowers lives, enriches careers, and energizes organizations here on CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm your host, Mark Franklin. You can find out more about me at careercycles.com. And the two other hosts of Career Buzz are Leanne Sachs at livinginthemoment.ca and Louisa Jewell at whydidyougo.com. Next Friday, I'll be hosted by Leanne Sachs, and I'll be with you on February 11th with a focus on international careers. Any comments on today's show, please email me, mark@careercycles.com. Thanks to my guests, David Brill, Deborah Stamen, and technical production today was by Julian Dunn. An MP3 of today's show is available on careercycles.com. Catch Career Buzz every Friday at 11 a.m. here on CIUT. That's it for today's live version of Career Buzz. Thanks for listening.